The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday delivered a passionate and much-anticipated speech at the U.S. Capitol. Netanyahu addressed Iran's nuclear program and the severe threat Israel feels it poses. But his visit and his speech sparked a political rift in Washington, although Netanyahu said that was never his intent.
I deeply regret that some perceive my being here as political. That was never my intention. I want to thank you, Democrats and Republicans, for your common support for Israel, year after year, decade after decade.
The Netanyahu speech competed for political attention with other headlines, including the U.S. Supreme Court's hearing this week of another challenge to the Affordable Care Act and questions raised about Hillary Clinton's approach toward email during her tenure as Secretary of State. This hour on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin helps us sort through these and other stories. Each month, Ken joins us with his veteran observer's eye on the political news of the nation. Let's hear from you, too. Your questions and comments for Ken are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. Excited to be back.
Well, before we dive into all the subjects, and boy, there's a lot this month, Ken, you have a trivia question for us.
Well, the trivia question is, as everybody knows, Hillary Clinton won the New Hampshire presidential primary in 2008. Before Hillary Clinton, what woman came closest in history? What woman came closest to winning the New Hampshire primary?
Okay, so the number again, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org. Last month, we had a great response to the trivia question. So here it is again. Let me make sure I got it right, Ken. Hillary Clinton won the New Hampshire primary in 2008. Apart from Clinton, what woman had the best showing in a New Hampshire presidential primary over time? That's
history,
the question.
Exactly.
All right.
Right.
Again, the number, if you know the answer, no Googling. That's not in the spirit of this. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Exchange listeners, if you know the answer, give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. And boy, Ken, let's dive into that speech by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Just remind us why this address ruffled so many political feathers in Washington.
Well, there were so many reasons and so many ways it's ruffled feathers. First of all, the way it came about to begin with, House Speaker John Boehner, a Republican, and his people worked out the invitation with Prime Minister Netanyahu without first going to the White House. Now, Congress does have the authority. Congress can invite whomever it wants. But given the fact that they invited somebody, the Republican Congress invited somebody who is clearly at odds with President Obama, not only on the negotiations regarding Iranian nuclear capabilities, but Obama and Netanyahu don't see eye to eye on many issues, including Israeli settlements and things like that. So there's always been the tension between Netanyahu and Obama and John Boehner and the Republicans who feel that President Obama has been doing whatever he feels like doing with his executive orders going beyond Congress. I mean, I'm thinking I'm going into their heads here, but it seems like they decided, well, we're just going to get Netanyahu here to talk about his reservations about the negotiations with Iran and tweak the president at the same time.
Well, and these Iran negotiations have been going on for a long time, right? There's been a lot of back and forth on this issue over several administrations, right, Ken?
There have, but there is a deadline coming up, and Secretary of State John Kerry is really doing everything he can to get this deal worked out. Now, it was interesting. You played, I think, the perfect piece of tape for Netanyahu from yesterday's speech when he said, look, a lot of people say that this is about politics, and I regret that. But, of course, a lot of it is politics. I mean, who invites a foreign leader who's at odds with the president of the United States to give a speech to Congress? Democrats say that, you know, what if the Democrats invited the president of France during the Iraq War to come and criticize U.S. involvement in the Iraq War? It would be the same thing. So a lot of it is politics. But at the same time, there is, as you say, there is a deadline coming up with Iran. And most people feel that. Well, there was a fear that the United States will not be, there will be more concessions from the U.S. on getting this deal. And as Netanyahu said yesterday, I'd rather have no deal than a bad deal. And there are a lot of Democrats and not, I'm sorry, there are a lot of Republicans and not too few Democrats who fear that a bad deal is in the making.
Well, and speaking of the difficulty that this posed for Democrats, here's an email from Peg in Concord that came in before the show, Ken. She says, I'm disappointed that all our reps, meaning New Hampshire's members of Congress, attended Netanyahu's speech. I feel Boehner weakened our country in the office of president by his invitation, bypassing the president, bringing him in when the talks with Iran are at a critical point. Peg says these talks could be some of the most important negotiations we have entered into in many years, and it is wrong for one leader who opposes them for his own purposes to interfere or have any say in the matter. Now, Ken, you're not a foreign policy expert. You're a political guy. But what were some of the political difficulties that this speech, and whether to attend or not, presented for Democrats, including the Democrats in New Hampshire's congressional delegation?
Well, first of all, I mean, obviously President Obama resented the fact that Netanyahu came to the Congress to criticize his foreign policy. The White House said that one of the reasons they didn't want to meet with Netanyahu, although this may be, not completely legitimate, but they said, well, you know, Netanyahu is up for re-election in a couple of weeks, and we don't want people who are involved in election to don't want to interfere with the local politics of their country, but it just seemed like a lot of Democrats felt that there was a deliberate snub, a deliberate jab at the president, and they felt that we'd rather sit home or watch it on TV or something than attend in the House chamber. Now, there were Democrats who did attend. Former Speaker and now House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi was there, and she said she was livid at other things that Prime Minister Netanyahu said, that she was nearly in tears, and she was like ready to fight back. I mean, she was so angry.
She said it was an insult, didn't she? Isn't that the word she used? It was an insult.
Look, you have a prime minister from another country coming basically saying that, you know, I mean, it's interesting. Netanyahu started the speech by saying that, well, I have great respect and I have thank you, President Obama, for everything you've done for Israel. And then he spent the rest of the 40 minutes, I should say, blasting the president for naivety regarding the negotiations with Iran.
Well, again, the number here in the exchange for you to join Ken Rudin, our political junkie, who joins us once a month to cover the top political stories of the nation, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Ken is here first Wednesday of every month, helping us catch up on the news and also offering us some fun political trivia. The question this month is, Hillary Clinton won the New Hampshire primary in 2008. Apart from Hillary Clinton, what woman had the best showing in a New Hampshire presidential primary? Lots of folks, Ken, who think they know the answer. Let's go to them. And Marty's in Dalton. Hi, Marty. You're on the air with Ken Rudin.
Hi there. Is it Geraldine Ferraro?
Geraldine Ferraro actually never ran for president. She was, of course, the Democratic candidate for vice president in 1984, but never ran for president.
Okay. Marty, thanks for that one. And let's try Amanda in Deerfield. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Was it Sarah Palin?
Well, same with Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin was the Republican nominee for vice president in 2008. With John McCain. She hinted about running for president, but never ran for president.
Interesting. And we actually had a couple other callers guessing Geraldine Ferraro. So there's your answer, folks. It's not Geraldine Ferraro. Let's try Clara.
Or Sarah Palin.
Clara in Goffstown. Go ahead, Clara. You think you know?
Well, I'd like to guess one of my heroines, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that Clara's doing heroin. I think drugs are bad for people, and we should let people know that. No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't make jokes like that. Claire is exactly right. It is Margaret Chase Smith. But you know what's fascinating about this answer is that Margaret Chase Smith, when she ran for president in 1964, she got only 2.3% of the vote. So aside from Hillary Clinton winning in 2008, the best showing by a woman, by a female presidential candidate in history in New Hampshire was 2.3% by Margaret Chase Smith in 1964. That was the primary that won by Henry Cabot Lodge as a write-in. He beat Nelson Rockefeller and Barry Goldwater. But Margaret Chase Smith is the correct answer.
Okay. Well, Clara, thank you for calling in. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we cover some of the top political stories of the month with Ken Rudin, who joins us monthly here in the exchange. While we're talking about Hillary Clinton, Ken Rudin, let's talk about her possible quest for the presidency. Hillary Clinton has been talking a lot this time around about her experience as a woman, you know, 20, 30 years ago in largely a man's world. She gave a speech recently at a Silicon Valley women's conference. Let's hear what she said.
When I was a young lawyer and was pregnant, I worked in a small law firm and there was no family leave policy. It never come up before. I was the first woman to be a partner in that law firm. And so nobody said anything to me, and I didn't say anything to them. I just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
So there's Hillary Clinton again, talking a lot lately, Ken, about her experiences as a woman at a time when women weren't allowed to do certain things. What do you think about this emphasis?
Well, this is a tactic or a strategy she did not employ in 2008 when she first ran for president. All the attention seemed to be on Barack Obama, the newness of Barack Obama, and the history that Barack Obama would make, of course, being the first African-American elected president. Now, Hillary Clinton, of course, had the same history to go by, the first woman ever elected president, but she didn't run on that issue in 2008. She seems to be more comfortable talking about it, more cuddly in 2016. She seems to be talking more about being a grandmother and the joy of it and things like that. Now, there are some Democrats who are saying, say something of substance. What about the Keystone Pipeline? How do you feel about, you know, the battle against ISIS? Say something. But right now, she's still not a candidate. She may not announce until April. There were some reports saying she won't announce until July, but now it looks like it's April. But right now, she's very comfortable just talking about the history involved. And one of the strengths of Hillary Clinton's candidacy, aside from her experience of things like that, is the fact that she would make that kind of history.
Okay, and one more question for you after a break, Ken, about Hillary Clinton concerning her use of email while Secretary of State. Will also follow up on President Obama's Keystone Pipeline veto. All that plus your questions and comments for political junkie Ken Rudin. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us once a month. Ken is here giving his veteran observer's eye on the political news of the nation. You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Some of the topics we're covering this hour, the Netanyahu speech before the U.S. Congress yesterday. Also, another U.S. Supreme Court challenge to the Affordable Care Act and President Obama's recent veto of the Keystone Pipeline. But Ken, first, we were talking just before the break about Hillary Clinton and her approach toward possibly running for president this time around, focusing more on her experiences as a woman in a man's world. She got into trouble, though, recently, Ken, concerning email. What happened?
Well, the New York Times reported the other day that she only used personal email, a personal email account to conduct government business when she was Secretary of State. She did not use the government email. So basically, all her emails, or all her tens of thousands of emails during her 4 years as Secretary of State cannot be read investigated or for anything because they were private. So, of course, a lot of the Republicans who are out to you know, who were out to, actually, it was a Republican House committee on Benghazi. And of course, the Republicans are dying to connect Hillary Clinton to something nefarious about Benghazi. And so they were trying to get her emails. But as it turned out, they were not accessible because they were a personal account. Now, the Hillary Clinton people say, look, she didn't violate any law. You know, Colin Powell did this as well, and others have done that. But it plays into the perception of Hillary Clinton that she is secretive, that she likes to hide things, that she, you know, she's there's a lack of transparency. Whether that's fair or not, it just feeds into that. So right now, Hillary Clinton has not said anything, responded to it at all. But there is that feeling that once again, Hillary Clinton has tried to hide something. And, you know, and so, of course, the emails that have been released to the government, back to the State Department, it was Hillary's advisors who went through all her emails to decide what should be made public. And again, that, you know, for those conspirators, those with the conspiracy theories in mind, they say, well, this doesn't look right. So once again, Hillary Clinton is under suspicion for lack of transparency, the love of secrecy. And once again, I keep hearing, said, well, if only Elizabeth Warren would come and save our party. But I think that may not be happening either.
Let's take another call, Ken. And again, the number for you to join us with Political Junkie Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. And Linda in Newfield, go ahead. You're on the air with Ken Rudin.
Oh, thank you. This is a segue off the insult to the President of the United States by the Netanyahu speech. As I recall, though I wasn't actually born then, wasn't General MacArthur invited to speak before a joint session of Congress after President Truman had dismissed him for insubordination?
Oh, Linda, interesting question. Wow, and I feel like I should know that. I've read books about that whole era, but I don't remember, Ken. Do you?
Well, what I love about this question is that I never even thought of that. It never even occurred to me to draw a parallel to the Republicans in Congress. And Linda is exactly right. They invited Douglas MacArthur to come to Congress, and he got a rousing ovation. As I recall, he did not criticize President Truman. Now, of course, President Truman removed him from command during the Korean War because MacArthur was ready to invade China. I mean, he was really ready to go too far, and he overstepped his bound, and he basically put himself ahead of President Truman as far as, you know, deciding what to do. But I hadn't thought about that. But as I recall, I don't remember MacArthur coming and blasting Truman's Korea policy, which is basically what Netanyahu did. So I think Netanyahu, what he did yesterday, was more of a snub or an insult or an attack on the president. But the MacArthur parallel is an interesting one.
Okay. Linda, thanks a lot for the question. And,
I like that question a lot.
Thanks, Linda. The next call is Scott from Heartland, Vermont. Hi, Scott. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to simply say this, it seems a little bit ridiculous to me that the Democrats are really concerned about the president being snubbed. You know, they sent a clean bill. The Republicans helped send a clean bill about Homeland Security yesterday, which, as a very strict conservative, I would disagree with. However, they did that. And the president's trying to rewrite immigration reform, which a basic civics class would teach you. That's not his responsibility. His responsibility of the executive branch is to enforce the law, not write the law. And while all that's going on, you know, Nancy Pelosi's mad at some things that Netanyahu said. Instead of concerning himself with the president from her own party, trying to rewrite immigration reform, and essentially the Republicans, you know, saying, you know, he is the president. We do need a clean bill on Homeland Security. Let's just do the right thing. So,
well, Scott, I'm glad you called because this is something we definitely need to talk about. And Scott's right. There was a potential showdown on this issue that fizzled out yesterday, Ken, over funding for the Department of Homeland Security. So love your thoughts on what Scott says there. Thank you, Scott.
Well, what Scott mentioned, I mean, what Scott mentioned is a very important point, is one of the problems that the Republican Party has with President Obama. They feel that his executive actions, especially on immigration, are either extra constitutional or even unconstitutional. There are judges on different sides of the aisle, you know, who decide about this, but they feel that the president went beyond his powers to order these executive actions that would basically keep 5 million people here illegally from being deported. So that's part of the anger that the Republicans have regarding Obama immigration policy. And so what they wanted to do is at first they wanted to hold up the funding for the Department of Homeland Security, because the Department of Homeland Security is responsible for implementing Obama's immigration actions. When that didn't work, they said, okay, we will pass, and they did pass, a bill that fully funded the Department of Homeland Security, but there's a rider in the bill that said all money regarding Obama's immigration policy be taken out. Now, that passed the House, and that's fine. And Boehner says, okay, I passed it. But it went to the Senate, where the Democrats were filibustering it. There was no way the Democrats were going to allow a bill to come to a vote. I mean, we always talked about how obstructionist the Republicans were when they were in the minority. Well, Democrats can play the same game, and they do play the same game. And so they said, there's no way we're going to pass a bill that guts Obama's guts Obama's immigration policy. So Boehner tried to work out a deal, but the conservatives in his party would not let him do that. Finally, yesterday, with another deadline approaching, Boehner said, okay, we're going to pass a clean bill without any language about immigration, funding the Department of Homeland Security, and they did so. But it took two deadlines and some embarrassment for the Republicans before that finally happened.
Well, and conservatives like our caller were pretty upset with this, right, Ken?
Well, I mean, there are some people who say that they should have, President Obama must be held accountable for what he's doing about immigration, and here's one way to do it. Now, my argument would be that if the Republicans were so upset about what Obama was doing on immigration, pass your own bill. Pass an alternative to what the president is proposing. Remember, the Senate in June of 2013 passed overwhelmingly 68-32 a bill that would overhaul American immigration policy. But the House has never taken it up. Part of it is inside politics, that basically if you're a Republican and start to talk about a pathway to citizenship, you get tarred with the amnesty word and you get challenged by the Republican right in the primaries. So the Republican in the House never passed a bill. They just wanted to attach language to the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security funding. And I think the Republicans would have saved themselves a lot of aggravation and a lot of internal battles, because they're ready to, they're ready for John Boehner's scalp here. They just don't feel that he's too much of an accommodationist and too much of a sellout. But all they had to have done is just pass their own immigration bill, and they would have been in a good position, but they didn't do that.
Well, thanks for that call. And again, the number for you to join us, it's our Political Junkie Hour once a month with Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Join us as we cover some of the big political headlines of the past couple weeks. Here's another one I want to cover with you, Ken, and this concerns President Obama's recent veto at the end of February of the Keystone XL pipeline. Here's White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest explaining why the president vetoed the bill.
It circumvents a longstanding administrative process for evaluating whether or not infrastructure projects like this are in the best interest of the country. It does not represent a specific position on the pipeline itself.
What do you think of that, Ken? There's nothing to do with climate change or oil or jobs, all the arguments that we hear around this. Why? Can you put that in layperson terms for us, what that spokesman said?
I love that they call him Earnest, because that was not the most earnest response. I mean, the ostensible reason why President Obama vetoed the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline was that Congress overstepped its boundaries, that this is an executive decision. It should be up to the executive to make that decision. We are not deciding how we feel about the pipeline. We're not talking about the creation of jobs or the environmental hazards or anything like that. It's because Congress overstepped its bounds. Now, of course, there are member Republicans who say with a smile, well, Obama has been overstepping his bounds with immigration policy,
right,
and all that for a long time.
Yeah.
So that goes back and forth. But Look, we do get a sense that President Obama is not a fan of the pipeline. One, he thinks that the amount of jobs that the proponents say will be created is overstated. And two, he says that according to, and he's backed by many environmentalists who feel that that there is a big environmental risk in these kind of pipelines. Of course, there's already been a pipeline and that Obama approved in 2009 that is sending hundreds of thousands of gallons of gas through the country to the Gulf to be refined anyway. But this one, the veto was said to tell Congress to stay out of the administration's business, stay out of what the executive wants to do. But here's the thing, though. The fact is there were very few vetoes in the early part of the President Obama's administration because you had Harry Reid protecting his flank in the Senate. Now that the Republicans control both the House and the Senate, many people feel that the only way the Obama administration is going to deal with Congress is by veto. So we saw during the State of the Union address when President Obama said, look, if you're going to pass something that repeals the Affordable Care Act, I'm going to veto it. If you pass something that questions something I'm doing about immigration, I'm going to veto it. If you pass something that calls for stronger Iranian sanctions, I'll veto it. So, he's going to become the next Vito Corleone here because, there's so many vetoes that he's been threatening, and that may be what the final 2 years of the Obama administration is all about.
Well, and speaking of what the president said a couple months ago about that veto threat and his willingness to use it, he also said, I'll veto any threats, challenges to his signature domestic achievement, and that's the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Even the president calls it that. But apart from bills and vetoes, the U.S. Supreme Court this week, Ken, held hearings on a new challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Just remind us real quick what this challenge is about, and then we'll talk about the politics of it.
This is something. This is basically today the Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments, and this is a serious challenge. I mean, once again, another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, but it's a serious one. And basically the argument is that it's for the people who are getting – people should not be getting tax credits from the federal exchanges. That it's one thing to get them from the state exchanges, and there are 14 states that have state exchanges. But for the other 36 states that don't, this basically, if this challenge goes through, then the people would lose their tax credits for health care coverage. And that could mean as many as 8 million Americans who lose their health care coverage if the court rules in its favor. And
the subsidies that help people afford it
Exactly, the subsidies. Because otherwise the premiums would go up. It would be unaffordable. It would be the Unaffordable Care Act, not the Affordable Care Act. And it would put – and the question, we could talk about the politics later, as you say, but it is very significant, and everybody's going to watch what happens either late June or early July. We expect the court to rule. But they're hearing the oral arguments today.
Yeah, well, and this is going back in history a couple years, Ken, but just remind us how this idea of, okay, we have a state-based exchange and we've set it up and we're running it, or, hey, states like New Hampshire and most of the other states have exchanges that obviously take place here in New Hampshire but are done sort of in partnership with the federal government. I mean, that's the issue. And that was a political decision state by state, wasn't it? I mean, some states went ahead and said, yep, we're going to do this, and other states kind of weren't sure what to do, and that's where we are today now with all these
and
states.
And a lot of the states that have refused to go along with it is also there. Also, the problem with the Medicaid expansion, and a lot of Republican governors say that once again this is a federal intrusion into health care, and we are against it. But when you have a decision like that, you have states like Texas where there are millions of people who are just uninsured. A lot of the reason is politics, and that's kind of strange.
So you've got these states like New Hampshire that have federal / state exchanges instead of just having a state exchange. You have these subsidies that are being called into question by this lawsuit. I'm interested not so much for this in this instance, Ken, in terms of Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill, but what about governors in the states? More than 30. that have these exchanges. What are they thinking about this? Are they talking about this? Are they chiming on this debate? Or are they just saying, whoa, we're going to hold off and see what happens with this?
Well, they better, that's a very good question. They better not hold off. They better have a plan in mind, because if the Supreme Court rules, you know, this June or July that in this King versus Burwell, that basically the subsidies are over, these governors in the 36 states that don't have state exchanges are going to have to come up with an alternative. And of course, there'll be tremendous pressure on them, because otherwise, as I said, you'll have millions and millions of people suddenly without health insurance. They can't afford health insurance, and it'll be up to the governors to decide what to do to protect these people for coverage.
Again, our number here in the exchange with political junkie Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we cover some of the big headlines of the past couple weeks with Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Adam is waiting in Portsmouth. Hi, Adam. You're on the exchange with Ken Rudin. Go ahead.
Hi, Ken. I've always enjoyed your reporting, and I find you hilarious, and I find you brilliant. Oh, but I did want to ask you a question.
But, yeah, there's a but coming.
I did want to ask you a question about the gold you're reporting. I think your brief discussion of Hillary Clinton kind of summarizes what I get from NPR political reporting and from American political reporting in general. And it's a baseball card. You know, we get her stats, we get the date, we get her history. But ultimately, when we get to Election Day, what do Americans know about her? I mean, thanks to American political reporting, we really don't know where she falls on the issues. We really don't know what policy implications we could see in her presidency, because ultimately it's a horse race. And, you know, you're a brilliant guy and you provide amazing coverage, but, like, you know, just where is the real policy analysis?
You know, Adam, this is a great point, and it's a critique that comes up a lot. Thank you so much for calling. Go ahead, Ken.
I agree with everything Adam said, including the fact that I'm a great guy. No.
And that you're brilliant. Now,
Adam raises a very important point that political coverage in general almost exclusively is on the horse race. Now, as we get closer to 2016, when we're talking about September, October, November 2016, yes, it should be about the horse race. But you're absolutely right. The issue is, what does Jeb Bush think about X, Y, or Z? What does Hillary Clinton think about X, Y, or Z? Part of the problem is that Hillary Clinton is not sharing her views on many of the issues, but you're absolutely right. We're relying on polls and who's the front runner and things like that, and that's not good political reporting.
Okay, well, coming up, and I'm feeling guilty now, but I did want to talk about the straw poll that Rand Paul won just recently, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's political junkie time on The Exchange, where once a month we talk national politics with political junkie Ken Rudin, who joins us from Washington. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Your questions and comments as we cover some of the big political headlines of the last few weeks are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Ken, after that great call from Adam, sort of taking issue with political coverage, the horse race, the polls, not the substance, I'm feeling a little guilty about this next question, but I did want to ask you about the Conservative Political Action Conference that took place just recently.
Let me tell you why you shouldn't feel guilty. First of all, I think I kind of gave Adam a short shrift with an answer. Adam makes a very, very legitimate question.
Absolutely.
That the media on the horse race, who's up, who's down, who's the front runner, when we don't know where anybody stands. Now, this is exactly the time when we should be talking about what does Jeb Bush say about Common Core standards or immigration? What does Ted Cruz say? What does Martin O'Malley say? And all those things. So that's absolutely correct. But the CPAC, this is not a media creation. CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, that, you know, has its meeting every year. I was going to say it has its annual meeting every year, which would be very bad journalism and bad English. But anyway, so it had its straw poll last weekend at its conference, and it's very unscientific. Most of a lot of the people who vote are under 18 years old. Most of the people.
Wait, under 18?
Yeah, well, anybody could vote. I mean, basically anybody could vote there. Jeb Bush bust people in, Rand Paul. They bust people in all the time. It's not scientific. I mean, it's just really not. But anyway, As it turned out, Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, won the straw poll for the third year in a row. Matter of fact, I think between Rand Paul and Ron Paul, they've won CPAC straw polls 5 out of the last 6 years.
Maybe the P stands for Paul.
Exactly, which lets you know exactly about the people who participate in it. But anyway, so it doesn't say that much. I mean, obviously, Rand Paul, you know, in 2008, Mitt Romney won the straw poll, and of course, the nomination went to John McCain. I think the last person who won the straw poll and went on to win the nomination was George W. Bush in 2000. But, you know, it's a fun exercise. The media have fun with it. Conservatives take it very seriously. But there's a little bit of nuttiness as well. I mean, once again, Donald Trump will stand up and say that he's the only person who could defeat Hillary Clinton. And although a lot of people do feel that Donald Trump is the heir apparent, but that doesn't mean he's going to be the nominee in 2016. Sorry about that bad hair joke. But anyway, maybe Adam doesn't think he likes me anymore because of that joke. But look, it's a fun exercise, but it does tell you something about the conservative philosophy and what the conservatives are thinking, especially when somebody like Jeb Bush stands up at CPAC and everybody thinks, the establishment at least thinks, that he would be the strongest Republican in November of 2016, perhaps against Hillary Clinton. And yet he gets booed at these conservative places, either because he talks about Common Core education standards, how he feels about immigration, the fact that he's another Bush, and that doesn't go over well with conservatives. But so it's a lot of fun covering these things. It's a lot of fun watching what happens there. But sometimes it does send a message that it's something to consider.
Well, boos for Jeb Bush at CPAC and cheers for Rand Paul, as you said. Let's hear some of the drama surrounding the unveiling of those straw poll results.
Can we get a drum roll? Come on. How about the audience? Can I get a drum roll from you?
And then show the slide.
Show us the slide. The winner of the CPAC 2015 presidential straw poll is Rand Paul.
Again, announcing the results of that straw poll. So,
and no surprise. Yeah. No surprise. Again, 3 years in a row and 5 of the last 6 for the polls.
Okay, so to Adam's point, though, about we talk so much about, you know, who's up, who's down. What does, substance-wise, Rand Paul stand for? What issues is he running on substantively in this presidential campaign? Because, you know, most people think he's going to run.
Well, yeah, well, he's definitely going to run. The question is whether he's trying to somehow change the Kentucky state law that allows him to run for re-election and for the presidency at the same time. Right now, the Democrats control the state government in Kentucky, so he's having a hard time with that. But anyway, he's clearly going to run for president by all indications. What he stands for and what his father stood for was the non-interventionist foreign policy that the Republicans have pushed for so many years. We always think of in the old days of the Republicans being the isolationists during World War II, you know, let's stay out of war. But under George W. Bush, we have Iraq, we have Afghanistan, and that by and large seemed to be pretty popular with a large segment of the Republican Party, but not the libertarian wing of the party, which Rand Paul represents. And he says that, you know, we're spending too much money on foreign aid, we're getting involved in other countries' business, things like that. Now, some of his followers, some of these libertarians, some of the Ron Paul supporters went a little too far, and they said that basically that 9/11 was a concoction created by the Bush administration to get us involved in war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that maybe goes a little bit beyond credibility. But Rand Paul is smart enough to know the mistakes his father made, Ron Paul, when he ran for president several times. Rand Paul seems to have a little more sense of the political realities there.
So non-interventionism will be part of what Rand Paul talks about on the campaign trail. Just real quick, what else can, I'm guessing, opposition to Common Core, for example? That'll be a touch point between him and Jeb Bush.
Yes. Rand Paul is interesting. He claims he's a libertarian, but I think, but in theory, a libertarian would not care what the government has to say about abortion and a woman's right to abortion. And Rand Paul is clearly pro-life. And so you say, well, if It's not up to the government to decide. Rand Paul does not fall into that category. And also when the President Obama was talking about opening up relations with Cuba, and Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who's also a likely presidential candidate, Marco Rubio was very angered by that, upset with that. Rand Paul basically defended the president, saying, Marco Rubio, you're in the past. This is no longer 1959. This is a new era, and why not open it up? So Rand Paul is trying to change and massage his foreign policy views as he can.
Let's talk a little bit about those boos for Jeb Bush. What was that about, Ken?
Well, it's a combination of things. The fact is, first of all, he's not the most dynamic speaker. He's not the most charismatic guy. I mean, Marco Rubio and Rand Paul and so many others, Scott Walker, and we haven't mentioned Scott Walker yet, and he's somebody we need to talk about. But Jeb Bush does not have that kind of charisma. He's a very thoughtful guy. He was always thought to be the smart Bush. And I mean, this is a knock on George W. Bush, but he was always felt to be the more substantial Bush, more involved in policy as opposed to just, good feelings. But he is, as he said from the beginning, look, he's very conservative. He had a very conservative 8 years as governor of Florida, and his record proves it. And to say that he's not a true conservative baffles me. But at the same time, he said that there are, this immigration policy needs to look. We have 11 million people here illegally, yes, but we're not going to deport everybody. We're not going to do what Mitt Romney suggested, the self-deportation. We're going to somehow, we're not going to deport them. They should have some kind of either a pathway to citizenship or to have some kind of a hope of playing a meaningful role in society. And Jeb Bush has also said, given the demographics of this country, given the change that's happening, for the Republican Party to rely on just white elderly voters, well, that's not going to last for much longer. Obviously it hasn't worked in recent presidential elections, and it's going to be even worse for the GOP in subsequent elections. So they have to pay attention to the changing demographics, and the Latino community in this country is something to pay attention to. But when you have the Republican Party battling Obama on immigration over and over again, it makes Jeb Bush's task even harder. And when he tries to make that case at places like CPAC, he gets booed for it.
Well, and just real quickly, one last question on Jeb Bush. And I do want to ask you about Scott Walker. Jeb Bush has some personal experience with this immigration issue, right?
Well, I mean, he speaks. I mean, I don't know if this is what you were asking. He speaks fluent Spanish. His wife, he met his wife in, I think, Mexico or Latin America. And, she is, of course, a Latina. But he also got a very strong support from Hispanic voters in his three times running for governor of Florida. And, when we see how that 75-78% of Latinos voted for Obama over Romney in 2012, a similar number voted for Obama over McCain in 2008. There are some people who say, well, that Jeb Bush can be the kind of candidate who could break that lock on the Latino vote for the Republican Party.
Sort of a crossover.
Other conservatives say, exactly, but that may not be enough for some of the true blue conservatives.
Again, our number here in the exchange with political junkie Ken Rudin, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Ken, just a couple more political threads to finish up with you. At this CPAC conference, there are so many candidates possibly vying for the Republican nomination. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker spoke at CPAC responding to a question about how he would handle the threat of ISIS, how he would hope to see the next president approach this so-called Islamic State. Let's hear what Scott Walker said.
We will have someone who leads and ultimately will send a message not only that we will protect American soil, but do not take this upon freedom-loving people anywhere else in the world. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Okay, so that's Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker speaking again at this CPAC. And you need to untangle this for people who haven't been following it as closely as you can. What's he talking about? If I can, you know, deal with 100,000 protesters,
well, first of all, a lot of people were upset about that quote. He's basically, they were saying that he was comparing the 100,000 people who protested his efforts to end collective bargaining rights for public employee unions as governor. Remember, he was part of a recall campaign in 2012.
I remember that,
and
yeah.
There were large protests against him in Madison. So he said, if I can deal with 100,000 protesters, I can deal with ISIS. And of course, everybody said, well, he's comparing these protesters in Madison to the Islamic State and the beheadings and all that. That's a little bit of a stretch. But Scott Walker, we should pay attention to what Scott Walker is doing, because when he was tried, when they tried to recall him in 2012, he reached out to a massive national conservative audience saying, the unions are out to get me. I need your help. He suddenly became the darling of the anti-unions effort in the Republican Party. And Walker he finished a strong second to Rand Paul in that meaningless straw poll at CPAC. He was at a meeting in Iowa not too long ago where he got very strong reviews. So he's somebody to watch. His views on abortion have changed. His views on a lot of things have changed. It's one thing to get reelected governor in a blue state like Wisconsin. It's another thing to take that record and run for president. So he is clearly moving more to the right than he was when he was running for governor. But a lot of conservatives like what they hear in Walker, and he's somebody to be watched. One more thing about Jeb Bush, though. Jeb Bush says he will not do what Mitt Romney and other Republicans have done. He will not pander to the right wing. Mitt Romney's changed his views on many issues in 2012 to hopefully that the conservatives will see him in a better light. Jeb Bush says, look, I'd rather lose the primary and win the general election. In other words, he'd rather lose some conservative support and not pander, and hopefully he'll win, be able to rally the majority of the country in the general election.
So that's the old adage, right? You run to the right if you're a Republican in the primary, you run to the left if you're a Democrat in the primary, and then you run to the center in a general election. Jeb Bush is saying, I'm not going to do that.
Right, exactly. What you just described was Richard Nixon's advice to candidates, run to the right in the primary, run to the center. But when Mitt Romney ran so far to the right during the debates, during the caucuses, during the primaries, it was difficult for voters to believe his turn to the center in November in the general election. And Jeb Bush says, I'm not going to play that game.
And Scott Walker has backpedaled, from that that quote about ISIS, if I can take on protesters, I can take on ISIS. He's since said, look, please don't think that I'm conflating the two,
the reporters are asking him questions like when Rudy Giuliani said Obama doesn't really love America. Then they asked Scott Walker that. And Scott Walker says, well, I don't know if the president loves America. I mean, he should have said that's a stupid question. And one, I don't like Obama's policies, but I don't question whether he loves America or not. He has to learn that he has to learn how to answer the questions the right way if he's going to be successful in 2016.
Well, and Ken, it's interesting. We talked at the very beginning of the show with your trivia question. Hillary Clinton won the New Hampshire primary in 2008. Apart from Clinton, what woman had the best showing in a New Hampshire presidential primary since then? And Clara answered it correctly. It was Margaret Chase Smith. What about at this CPAC meeting and in the Republican primary maneuvering in general? What women are there, if any?
Well, I mean, of course, Sarah Palin always hints, and there's always, and we saw what happened to Michelle Bachmann in 2011. She won the Iowa straw poll, and then 6 months later during the Iowa caucuses, she finished dead last. There are no women being talked about on the Republican side. Matter of fact, on the Democratic side is where the women action is. Of course, the progressive wing is hoping for a Elizabeth Warren candidacy. One bit of news this week is that the longest-serving woman in congressional history, Barbara Mikulski, the senator from Maryland, announced her retirement. So that's also a big loss for women, for women in politics and women who have fought for women's rights for so long.
On the Republican side, Carly Fiorina, possibly?
She's right. Carly Fiorina, right. She is running. She was at CPAC, and she was one of the people who, but basically, you know, she ran for the Senate not too long ago against Barbara Boxer in California, got clobbered, and she's hoping to make some kind of a headway in 2016. But she's raising staff, and she has a lot of money, but her message is not getting through, at least not at this point. We have the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary about 11 months away.
Well, and yeah, I was just going to say, in about a year from now, Ken, we'll be talking about what happened and what happens next. It's hard to believe. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll talk to you next month around this same time.
Thanks, Laura, and I agree with everything Adam said about me.
Take care, Ken. Again, that's political junkie Ken Rudin. Joins us once a month, the first week of the month, here on The Exchange. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.